Discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody. It's 11 o'clock, and thanks for joining us for the 56th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Thank you for that, Dr. Mathis. And if you would, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Sure. So I'm sure, that our listeners recognized my rather mundane version of Jingle Bells. And even though it's not Christmas, it's sort of a song that you'll hear during the holiday season. And since we're talking about the psychology of holidays tonight, I thought that might be kind of a cutesy intro to our theme.
Fair enough. Thank you. So as Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode is entitled The Psychology of Holidays, which we will discuss in a moment. Before we get to tonight's discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so we are now into the 50-plus anniversary. I think it's the 51st anniversary, actually, just past the 51st anniversary. Probably, if not the famous, most famous recording of all time in popular music, but certainly one of the most famous. And it's been reissued in a deluxe edition and all this kind of stuff, which of course I own because I'm a huge freak of the Beatles. And of course I'm talking about Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. So the, excuse me, the anniversary super deluxe edition, but wait, don't order yet, actually came out last year, which is the 50th anniversary of the release of the recording. And they just released a similar version of the White Album this year, which I also got. But I wanted to give kind of a quick and dirty history and commentary on the Sgt. Pepper recording because it was such a seminal recording for them. It was, I think, released in early June of 1967. So they spent about 500 plus hours in the studio recording it. Roughly from November of 66 through April of 67. And they did so because after they were touring pretty extensively and playing all these big places where the crowds were mobbing them and they couldn't hear their own musical stuff because the people were screaming so loudly, I think they got fed up and said, you know, we're kind of done with touring. Why don't we go see what we can do in the studio and let's get, like, really creative. So for their eighth recording, which was Sgt. Pepper's, they went into the studio with their longtime producer, George Martin, or as I should refer to him, Sir George Martin, and put together this really seminal recording that just blew everybody's mind. So it was, as I said, it was done over a pretty long period. And initially, the recording was supposed to also include Strawberry Fields Forever. And it didn't. And it was also supposed to include Penny Lane. But what happened is they opted to release those as singles prior to the release of the record. So they were released, I think, in February. And after that, they went, okay, well, maybe we, you know, we kind of shot our wad. We can't be putting them on the Sgt. Pepper recording. So they got X'd out of the original recording. Now, on the anniversary Super Deluxe reissue kind of thing, they're included in there as part of it, and along with a bunch of stories of how those things got recorded, which for anybody who's as much of a Beatle freak as I am and or a studio recording freak as I am, I would definitely I would recommend it. For sure. So the other thing is, people who know about Sgt. Pepper know that it, you know, the front of the recording is them taking on the mantra of this fictional alter ego of their Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, with cardboard cutouts of them as the Beatles back in their Liverpool day, with their shag haircut kind of thing, and a bunch of other folks. There were cardboard cutouts of some of their heroes. And each one of them, basically minus Ringo, picked out some of their heroes and or people who were influential in one way or another in their lives and had them as cutouts in the background. And they were, it was supposed to constitute their ideal audience if they were to play for people who they could all, you know, play for and they could pick their audience. That was supposed to be like their ideal, you know, dream audience, so to speak. And okay. Ringo, as usual, did at the time, deferred and says, hey, you know, whatever the rest of the guys want, I'm good with. So John Paul George and Jan Harworth and Peter Blake and Robert Fraser all got together along with George Martin and some of the folks at EMI Capital and said, okay, you know, what are we going to do? So what was interesting, because this album came only, you know, months after the so-called, you know, we're more popular than the Beatles comment that John made that was completely blown out of proportion and misinterpreted and yada yada. At any rate, the two people that John wanted on his list that were the two top people on his list, which I thought was very interesting, was Jesus and Adolf Hitler. Yeah, Hitler was probably as a joke. That would be my, you know, that would But and did make and they did do a cutout, but he was omitted from the final picture. So obviously that didn't make it. And you know, they did not include Jesus because of the previous comment. And they thought, okay, we don't want to put that in there and have anybody think he's making fun or whatever. So those guys got X'd out of the final cut picture, so to speak. Which who did make it. And there were also pics of John were Stu Sutcliffe, who was the original bass player for the Beatles, who had died earlier during the Beatles' career and actually had quit the Beatles for a career in art. And that's why Paul started playing bass for them, because Paul played guitar originally for them. They had like three guitar players. So Paul switched to bass after Stu Sutcliffe left. So the other person that was were picked by John were Lewis Carroll, you know, who's the author of the Alice in Wonderland series, and Edgar Allan Poe. So I thought that was, well, because you notice there's a line in I'm the Walrus that refers to Edgar Allan Poe. So yeah, that's off Magical Mystery Tour, which is the album after this. So when they talked to Paul, he wanted some very interesting folks. So he's the guy that picked Edgar Rice Burroughs. William Burroughs, the beat poet, William Burroughs, not the author of the Tarzan books. And Aldous Huxley, right, who is the author of The Doors of Perception, which is where The Doors got their name from.
Yeah.
Right? And Fred Astaire, which I thought that was really an interesting mix of folks.
One of
these
things is not like the other ones.
yeah, really. And it was George who picked out Lenny Bruce and Bob Dylan and Carl Jung.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he also picked out Mahatma Gandhi and several of the other, some of his famous yogis, Hindu yogis at the time. But Gandhi got removed because people thought that, okay, well, he's kind of a sacred picture in India, and, oh, gee, we don't know if the Hindus are going to be insulted or whatever, they're going to take it the wrong way. And so that's when you see the front of the album cover and you see there's a palm tree there, the palm leaves, they're covering Gandhi's face.
Got it.
So, yeah. And so some of this was had to be done for political reasons, even though the Beatles were like, what the hell, right? And Shirley Temple Black was also included, and I don't know who picked her out. But the kind of funny thing about her was that she wanted to see the cover and hear the record before she gave her permission to do it and to receive an autograph copy for her children. And so I think she got all but to hear the record in advance because she said, no, we're not doing that. And eventually she relented, but when they picked Mae West, she eventually said, no, I'm not going to allow that because, you know, who would believe that I'm a member of a Lonely Hearts Club band? I mean, come on. But they eventually persuaded her to let the picture go. So I thought that was kind of cool. The funny thing about this is that Leo Gorcey, who was a famous kid actor who appeared in a bunch of movies, The Bowery Boys, The Dead End Kids, he was scheduled to be on there too, but he wanted to receive a fee. And they kind of went, no, you're done. So he was X'd out of the final picture. But he was, and I don't know which one of the Beatles picked him, but he was... he was scheduled to be in there, and when he lost money, they went, no, you're done. We're not paying Mae West. We're not paying you. So there you go. So the other thing is everybody thinks that when you look at the plants that are right above the Beatles, everybody goes, oh, they're marijuana plants, right? They're peperomia plants. They're not marijuana plants. So it kind of dispels some of the myths that people had about that. But irrespective of that, it is probably one of the most famous recordings ever and certainly one of the most influential records of the time. And so I just thought it'd be kind of neat now that we're on the 51st anniversary of that, a little past the 51st anniversary. I thought that we would I do like an homage to that, and I may do an homage to the White Album next time, since that just came out. The anniversary of that just came out. And so anybody who's a Beatle freak needs to get these. They are the bomb. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
All right. Thank you for that. Very interesting. Again, we will be taking calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. So please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. All right. Tonight's show is called The Psychology of Holidays. It seems like the majority of people in our society and culture enjoy at least some of the holidays that occur every year, some more so than others. On this show, we have talked in the past about psychological issues connected to this upcoming holiday season in particular, although much of what we will discuss covers other holidays as well and the whole process in general. In the past, we have done episode 9 on holiday depression. That was a three-parter. This was part 1. That was in November of 2016. Episode 10 was the second part, maintaining sobriety and health during the holidays. And that was December of 2016. And episode 11, which was the third part, reasonable and rational New Year's resolutions. And that was in December of 2016. Also, we've done episode 35, The Grand Illusion, in December of 2017, which was about the myth of perfect holidays, which enters a little bit into what we'll talk about tonight. And episode 36, Another Auld Lang Syne, in December of 2017, which is about resolutions and guilt. So tonight, we would like to take a look at the very phenomenon of holidays themselves, in order to understand why we have so much emotional energy around this topic in particular. Some of this may be more sociology and culture studies than psychology, but the three are all intertwined. So tonight we will first discuss an overview of the psychology of holidays, then the purpose, history, and sociology of holidays, the dark side of holidays, depression, marketing, privilege, peer pressure, and cultural butchering, and conclusions. And before we get into this real heavily, I'm going to check with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you'd like to bring up before we start.
Nope, I'm good. Thank you.
All right, fabulous. Okay, so part 1, an overview of the psychology of holidays. At the end of the day, we as humans are driven to create a pecking order, labels for each other for brevity of judgment and understanding, and a tribe to which we belong for survival imperatives. The saber-toothed tigers of our world may be gone, but those primal instincts remain, and subconsciously they form the structure of most modern human societies, at least in the ways in which they are all similar. Rituals, traditions, and customs are part of that biological imperative. They show us how we fit in with our tribe and how we preserve our pasts and our cultures and traditions so that we are part of something iconic and timeless. They tell us who is safe and where we belong. Also, life can be chaotic, random, and out of our control. And so another survival behavior is to create structures so that we have something we can, quote, count on. Rituals are one form of this. Holidays are a specific form of ritual, and rituals are important to our society. Why do rituals matter? What is their purpose? Tonight, we're going to look at the general purpose of rituals, followed by how holidays in specific fit into that. Rituals and holidays fill a psychological need for us as individuals. It has to do with framing our place in our respective societies and cultures. They are a way of belonging and receiving status and credit, as well as reassurance and commemoration. Holidays, even though the word etymology is from holy days, can be secular or religious, and we will examine the roles of each, how they differ, and how they influence one another. We will also talk about the anxiety and stress that many people experience, a natural byproduct of feeling peer pressure to conform to other people's expectations, about holidays, whether it is family, society, the marketing industry, religious institutions, etc. To keep our discussion clear tonight, let's take a quick look at a couple of the terms so that we have clarity in tonight's talk. I have a little snip from, this is from a website called Quora.com, and it is where lay people come and they weigh in on questions. So it's giant discussion thread that's left up as an archive. And this particular thread was, what is the difference between rituals and traditions? And one of the answers that was voted the top accepted answer was, a ritual is a sequence of activities involving gestures, words, and objects performed in a sequestered place and performed according to a set sequence. And this may be relevant. The original poster is not American. I believe they're from India. For example, a wedding ritual, a death ritual, etc. Rituals are the set of activities that must be followed at a particular time, place, or event. A tradition is a belief or behavior passed down within a group or society with symbolic meaning or special significance with origins in the past, for example, an Indian tradition. The word tradition is used differently in different contexts, but the ultimate meaning is to pass the knowledge which was acquired in the past to the next generations. All right, so that's the end of the Quora discussion. Here are some vetted definitions so that we don't confuse topics, because part of the contention around this topic is misunderstandings or lack of recognizable standardization. And all of these definitions are sourced from the OED. So the OED says about ritual. As a noun, it can be a religious or solemn ceremony consisting of a series of actions performed according to a prescribed order. Subset 1.2, a series of actions or type of behavior regularly and invariably followed by someone. As an adjective, it can be arising from convention or habit. And the origin of the word is late 16th century as an adjective from Latin ritualis, from ritus, see the word rite, R-I-T-E. The OED says of ceremony, a formal religious or public occasion, especially one celebrating a particular event, achievement, or anniversary. As a mass noun, the ritual observances and procedures required or performed at grand and formal occasions. And the origin of the word is late Middle English from Old French ceremony, O-N-I-E, or Latin ceremonia, C-A-E-R-I-M-O-N-I-A, which is religious worship. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing the Latin correctly. Feel free to let me know if I didn't. So then the last word is tradition. And the OED says that tradition is the transmission of customs or beliefs from generation to generation, or the fact of being passed on in this way. It is also an artistic or literary method or style established by an artist, writer, or movement, and subsequently followed by others. An additional definition, but not relevant to tonight that much. In theology, tradition is a doctrine believed to have divine authority, though it may not appear in official scripture. And the origin of this is late Middle English from Old French tradition, or from Latin traditio, T-I-O, from tradere, to deliver or betray, from trans, across, and dare, give. And before we get into the next part, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Matha, see if there's anything you'd like to add.
No, I'm good.
Okie dokie. So the next part is the purpose, history, and sociology of holidays, which is kind of a continuation of the first part. So regarding the history of ritual, the word ritual is first recorded in English in 1570 and came to use in the 1600s to mean the prescribed order of performing religious services, or more particularly, a book of these prescriptions. And the source for that is Wikipedia, citing, I'm not going to pronounce this, P-O-U-D-E-W-I-J-N-S-E. And they wrote a book called British Roots of the Concept of Ritual, and that's where this is from. While the earliest occurrences of the word is religious, it is agreed that the modern day definitions can be either religious or secular, community driven or personal. And the next part I want to talk about is an article, and this is talking about the oldest rituals in, not even in our society, pretty much in our species. And just to give you an idea of how far back this goes in our behavior. So this is from World's Oldest Ritual Discovered, Worshipping the Python 70,000 Years Ago. And again, not going to try to pronounce this. This is by Yngvevogt.
Yngve.
Thank you. And this is translated by Alan Lewis Ballardinelli and was written in February of 2012 in Apollon Research Magazine from the University of Oslo. And in this article, they say, while up till now, scholars have largely held that man's first rituals were carried out over 40,000 years ago in Europe, it now appears that they were wrong, both about the time and the place. A new archaeological find in Botswana shows that our ancestors in Africa engaged in ritual practice 70,000 years ago, 30,000 years earlier than the oldest finds in Europe. This sensational discovery strengthens Africa's position as the cradle of modern man. More than 70,000 years ago, in a small cave in Botswana, human sacrifice spearheads to the python. And this is just to give you guys perspective about ritual and its place in our development. Okay, so it's the sociology and societal value of ritual. What is the purpose of doing rituals? This is another Quora discussion. This was addressed on May 28th of 2018. And the user posts, in the words of the great philosopher Abed Nadir, quote, pardon my hiccups, chaos already dominates enough of our lives. The universe is an endless raging sea of randomness. Our job isn't to fight it, but to weather it together on the raft of life, a raft held together by those few rare, beautiful things that we know to be predictable. Us, end quote. Rituals, if you look at them, operate on two levels. Some are enforced socially, while others are more personal. And both of them, in essence, attempt to do the same thing, enforce a meaningful structure on life or the world as we see it. By and large, the world just ticks on and keeps on ticking on without giving a damn about anyone, an endless series of moments far outspanning anyone's life. It doesn't stop or helpfully provide guidelines and careful demarcations of life events. So we create those. And then next, the below article explains some of the purposes of holiday traditions and some of the pitfalls, which we will discuss in more detail later on in tonight's show. So this article is Thinking Sociologically About Holidays by Karen Sternheimer, and this was written in January of 2013 at everydaysociologyblog.com. Quote, as you begin to get back to in your non-holiday routine, now is a great time to use our sociological imaginations to think about the many sociological concepts that help us understand end-of-year routines. This in particular was talking about Christmas and New Year's. First, rituals. Sociologist Emile Durkheim saw rituals as a form of social glue, holding societies together. Shared experiences like religious and secular celebrations may help create a feeling of commonality. As sociologist Diana Kendall discussed in her book, Framing Class, during the holidays, media coverage tends to highlight giving to the less fortunate more than other times of year. She found that news stories tend to be more sympathetic and less critical of the poor, highlighting their humanity and stressing our common bonds. Whether the rituals are gift-giving, religious worship, or other cultural practices, they serve to unite us with the people we celebrate them with. Wishing strangers happy holidays, Merry Christmas, or Happy New Year extends these bonds beyond our immediate social group. The next concept is families. Holidays often reinforce family connections through visits or exchanging cards or gifts. People who lost loved ones over the past year often experience their loss more profoundly during the holiday season. Holidays are also a way of welcoming new members into a family by including them in rituals and family photos. Parents might view a baby's first celebration as a special milestone, too. Of course, family conflicts can arise more acutely during the holidays, particularly in blended families where tension exists between ex-spouses or rituals are different from past celebrations as families merge. The third aspect is role conflict, that's R-O-L-E. Seeing family members can be complicated by something called role conflict, when we feel competing demands for our time due to the many social roles we play. Students returning home from college or on break for the first time might especially experience role conflict. Newly accustomed to independence, readjusting to parents' expectations of being in charge may be difficult. While to the parent, the student is a child and often still financially and emotionally dependent, the student has a new role as a young adult. Adults who have children themselves and are visiting their own parents may be treated both as a child by their parents and as a parent by their child. Conflict can arise when grandparents discipline grandchildren or attempt to override a parent's decision during a visit, undermining a parent's authority and reinforcing their status as child. Another common way people experience role conflict during the holidays is when visitors arrive and their role as host may conflict with their role as parent or employee if they need to be at work. Often I hear of family conflicts arising when a guest expects to be entertained or escorted around town while the host still has their regular responsibilities and is not on vacation. And the last aspect that they discuss is consumption. Hosting family members, cooking holiday meals, and buying presents can get expensive and are central facets of the holiday ritual, highlighting our culture of consumption. I happened to be shopping the weekend before Christmas amidst traffic, crowds, and long lines. Nobody I saw looked like they wanted to be shopping. That would include me, being the author. But within our consumer-based society, purchasing gifts has become defined as a way to show our love and gratitude. And that is the end of quotes from that article. And then I'd like to include some snips from an additional article by Sternheimer from 2015, which is expounding on the structure of holiday rituals. And this one is called Sociology and Holiday Rituals by Karen Sternheimer, December 2015, again from everydaysociologyblog.com. And again with the Emile Durkheim, that's one of her favorites, I think. So, quote, for Emile Durkheim, one of sociology's key 19th century thinkers, shared values and beliefs helped to form society itself. Emphasizing particular values during end-of-year holidays like giving, connecting with family and friends through visits, cards, or well wishes serves a very important purpose. He contends that societies are more than just a collective of individuals, but rather people learn to be part of an already existing society. Holidays aid in this process. He also wrote extensively on religion, noting that it serves as social glue that holds people together, emphasizing shared values that help people feel part of the larger collective group. Durkheim argued that a central tenet of religion involves maintaining a separation between the sacred and profane, the sacred being special and reserved for celebrations and worship, while the profane is mundane and part of everyday life. Although the profane, spending heavily on gifts often supersedes the sacred, these shared rituals enable diverse groups of people to celebrate in similar ways, echoing Durkheim's idea of collective consciousness. The secularization of rituals may bring larger groups of people together, but it can also cause members of these once distinct groups to lament a loss of their own separate collective consciousness. We see this in the backlash against using the phrase, quote, happy holidays. Even rituals that people don't particularly enjoy but participate in can create a sense of solidarity. I regularly hear people complain about decorating their homes, shopping, gift buying, and having family over, even commiserating with others who also dread these tasks, enables people to bond. Holiday rituals are often about attempting to live up to the expectations of others, what Durkheim might describe as maintaining social integration. Rituals also sometimes produce reciprocity. We had you over last year, so you have to have us in your home this year. I get you a gift, you get me a gift, and so on. True giving should be about giving without expectations. There's an unexpected comment there, sorry. But reciprocity helps create and maintain social ties. People who can have extensive mailing lists of people they barely know for their Christmas and New Year's cards can relate to this. The ties may be extremely weak, maybe limited to an exchange of cards or messages once a year, but they are ties nonetheless, and reciprocity maintains these ties. Social media is central to the experience of rituals today. Not only do posts invite reciprocity, but social networking gives us new ways to engage in shared rituals. Changing a profile picture with an overlay to celebrate a holiday or commemorate an event is a new shared ritual, as is sharing a family photo of an event. One comedian colorfully requested that nobody share pictures of the Thanksgiving dinner on Facebook, since we'll all be eating the same thing that night again. Durkheim would likely say both the shared meal and the shared experience of being annoyed by people posting pictures of the turkeys helps create social cohesion. And with that, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you'd like to add.
Yeah, one of the things I want to talk about or mention is that people, if they really want to accentuate the existential / spiritual aspects of the holidays, they can do so by celebrating the so-called profane during the year in small ways. And let me give you an example of that. Excuse me. So one of the things that I like to do is what I call take a minute out to do a reality check and a gratitude check, because I take things, like a lot of people do, I suspect, I take things for granted, and then something happens and I start whining and bitching and moaning, even if only to myself, but I still find it annoying. So one of the things I do is when I get in those kind of whiny moods, or I get in those, oh gee, this is too hard or whatever, I ground myself by doing a ritual of sitting down and saying, okay, look, take a look around you. Look at what you have. Think about how blessed you are with the stuff that you have, that you've worked hard to get. And, you know, be thankful of that. Take a walk in the fresh air. The fact that you have legs and you can walk and you can smell, you have the sense of smell. You have the sense of sight. You have the sense of hearing. So making small profane gestures, so one of the rituals I have is that anytime I catch myself in a kind of funk mood or a whiny mood or a, you know, pissy mood or whatever, I do one of these rituals to myself. Mm-hmm. Anytime I think I'm getting overwhelmed and I have to make a decision about something and I don't feel comfortable doing it, one of the other rituals I have is a little mantra I go through in my head, which kind of helps to ground me. And so it's bringing the existential or spiritual into the profane and making the profane part of that, and in a sense ennobling the profane so that it isn't just profane anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things I don't do is I don't do things that for the holidays that I wouldn't ordinarily do, except some cards. So I do send cards over the holidays, but I don't send them to everybody. I send them only to special people. And during that time, I use that gesture to remind myself of their presence in my life and my gratitude for having them. So it's kind of a nice way that I do to weave together, as George Harrison might say, the material world with the spiritual world.
Got it. Okay. That's fair. All right, let's go ahead and go to section 3, which is the dark side of holidays: depression, marketing, privilege, peer pressure, and cultural butchering. Now, I'd like to address what I have no doubt many of our listeners have already been thinking about the very minute we brought up the topic of tonight's show. Because holidays are rituals that are so ingrained into our social identity, roles, and sense of self and belonging, they can also be a significant source of anxiety or pain as we experience deep conflicts of personal expectations that don't always match. I've identified some categories of problems to discuss. The first one, most obvious, is holiday depression. Depression and anxiety are probably the most common downsides to holidays because so many of us try to live up to the often conflicting or unreasonable expectations of others. We want to be liked. We want to be invited to things. Some of us really don't enjoy some rituals around various holidays and really actually would rather not be invited, but are harassed to show up against our comfort level, and we try to be mutual and go. This show, as mentioned in the beginning of the program, has covered this specific phenomenon specifically, so that's too many specifics, sorry about that, from the vantage point of traditional American culture, because there is that much to say about the toll that navigating holiday expectations can take on our mental health. And actually, before each section, I'm going to pause real quick and see if there's anything you want to add before I continue.
Well, how convenient, because I was just thinking that.
I could tell. Somebody was ticking.
How convenient. Yeah. So what I have to say about that is I'll try to make this short. What I would say to my listeners, to the listeners for our show, is that if you don't want to do something, don't be bullied into it. If you feel uncomfortable doing it, don't do it. Right? And if for some reason there's folks that you would just rather not be around, don't live up to somebody else's expectations. And if you have a holiday ritual or tradition that you don't like, create your own. Make something meaningful for yourself and just either do it by yourself if that's what you desire, or only invite those folks you really want to be around to share the ritual or tradition with you. Don't necessarily feel bullied into doing other stuff. Do not feel compelled to do monkey see, monkey do. That is not being rude. You are honoring yourself if you do that. Never, ever sacrifice your self-worth and self-identity and self-happiness on the altar of other people's happiness. Bad idea.
Actually, since you brought that up, that reminds me of a question. Do you have any advice for some of our listeners who might be sitting here going, well, that's easier said than done. My mother will just scream and there'll be drama and I would just rather not hear it, so I shut up and go. You know, when people are in those kinds of contentious situations and they are having to weigh the drama versus, you know, their peace of mind, do you have advice for them in those kinds of situations?
I do. Do you want me to give it?
Yes.
Yeah, I know. I'm being a brat. What can I tell you? And this is different from when.
You're getting cold.
Yeah, there you go. And actually, it's funny you should say that, because that's essentially a situation I faced when my parents were still alive. Some of our listeners know my mom just recently passed, and my dad passed about 5 years ago. So I am, being the last surviving person, I'm sort of the lone renegade here. But my parents had a very conflict-habituated marriage, and it was really not a happy time for me to go home and hear them bitching and screaming at each other constantly, which they did with some regularity and in some cases some ferocity. And it really just ruined it for me. And on my last trip home during one of the holidays, it was Christmas, it was really bad, and I found myself ending up, my parents' house is on a very large piece of land with a lot of trees around, and it was really, really bad, and I found myself walking outside because I didn't want to lose my stuff in front of them, and walked outside and just started crying and walked into the wooded area and just started spending time with some trees, which I'm sure our weekend listeners will go right on, and literally spent,
yes.
And I joke about it, but I'm really serious, literally spent the next hour and a half hugging trees and meditating in the woods and being thankful that I had a sanctuary to go to, and making a promise to myself that I was leaving that night and I was never coming home again, period, end of story, for any flipping reason, that it just wasn't worth it. And after dinner, I stayed long enough to have dinner, and I packed my stuff and said, I'm out of here. I was a little nicer than that, but that was essentially what happened. And my mom, you know, raised all kind of craziness, and I said, you know, Mom, I'm really sorry, and I'm really, you know, if you take this personally, I apologize, but it's not personal. I've asked you guys not to do this. You've done it for the last, you know, 8 or 10 years that I've come home, and you keep promising you're not going to do it, and I'm convinced that you're not going to change what you do. And that's fine. If that works for you guys, that's great. And, you know, far be it from me to try to get you to change your pattern. That's not my prerogative. But I don't want to be around it. I don't want to see it. I don't want to experience it. I'm out, and I'm not coming back. That doesn't mean I don't love you. That doesn't mean I don't want to talk to you. It's just, this is not worth it for me anymore. And it really puts a damper on me and my spirits and me wanting to be around you guys. And I don't want that to happen. So I'm leaving. And I left. I walked out. And I never went home again until I attended my father's funeral. And then I didn't go home again until I attended my mother's funeral. And that was because I didn't want to see how deteriorated my mom had become. This was a lady who had 10 IQ points on me. And she got demented very early on because of the stroke she gave herself over a myriad of reasons. At any rate, that was it. I never went home again. That was the end of the story. And I had no guilt about it whatsoever. And I had phone calls from my mom. Oh, aren't you coming home this Christmas? Aren't you coming home this Thanksgiving? Aren't you coming home for your birthday? No, I'm not. And again, I was not that flip, but I basically said, no, Mom, and you know why. Well, why are you punishing us? I'm not punishing you. I'm not punishing you guys. I'm honoring myself. There's a difference. I'm not doing it to be mean. I'm not doing it to punish you. I'm not doing it to be passive aggressive. I'm doing it out to try to save what little sanity I have left and not ruin it for me coming there, because I know it'll make you happy. But it won't make you happy enough not to scream and yell at each other while I'm there. So it's not worth it for me. And that's what I did. And that was probably, that was before my dad had his first major stroke and all the time. I mean, it was from the time that was the last Christmas I went home, from the time that my father died, it was probably 8 years. I didn't go home at all. And I was the guy that went home for all the birthdays, all the Christmases, all the Thanksgivings. I would, you know, I got sick of it. I wasn't going to do it anymore. It just wasn't worth it. It wasn't going to change, and it wasn't my place to make them change, and it wasn't their place to change to suit me, but it was my place to protect myself, and that's what I did. So I would encourage our listeners to do likewise. Draw your boundaries, know what your limits are, and hold to them, and I don't give a flip when anybody does. You have to honor yourself, or there will be nothing of you to help other people when they're in need, or to help yourself. If you don't take care of you, nobody else is going to do it.
Yeah. Fair enough. Okay. Let's go ahead and go to the next section, and then we'll stop and chit-chat about that too.
Great. Thank you.
Marketing and consumer gifts. Adding to many people's anxiety and expectations are the businesses and companies that use the holiday season to aggressively market to society and portray the perfect holiday as involving a lot of consumer spending. We not only have Black Friday, but marketers are trying to make nearly every holiday that can even remotely be tied to spending into a Black Friday-style mega sale. Veterans Day sales, Valentine's, St. Patrick's, Easter, 4th of July, back-to-school sales, ad nauseum. Many in society have been pushing back against it, but the 20th and 21st century mentality still responds to this ridiculousness because we are rather lazy as a culture and don't do the homework to realize we are being harassed to buy crap we weren't looking for to appease people we may not even like that much and who may not even reciprocate. So I'm going to pause here and see if there's anything that you'd like to comment on as far as consumer issues with holidays.
Yeah, and my advice is very similar to what was on the first point. Know what you want to do. Know with whom you want to, know to whom you want to buy a gift and give a gift and expect nothing in return, by the way, FYI. You give a gift because it makes you feel good. Ultimately, you give a gift for you. All right. In fact, I would argue every single thing we do as people, we do for ourselves. And if we do it for the right reasons for ourselves, it's not being narcissistically selfish. It's being what I call self-enhanced selfish. If you do it for you and it makes you feel good and it makes somebody else feel good too, great. But if you do it for you, you really don't have to have somebody thank you. Because you're so happy that you did what you thought was the right thing. So if you think the right thing is to give somebody a gift, whether it's a small gift or a large gift, do it and expect nothing in return. And you will feel good because you will have no expectations. And if they do something back that you like, so much the better. But don't be bullied into getting somebody something because you think it's an obligation. Don't do it. You're dishonoring yourself and you're only resenting it and you're not really getting the gift in the spirit of giving the gift, because ultimately sharing a gift is very much to me like when I cook food for people, I'm sharing part of me, part of my energy, part of my love, part of the showing that I care about them. So why would I give somebody a gift that I don't like? Well, I don't. So it's really just that simple. Honoring yourself. Well, back to that again.
Yeah. That actually kind of reminds me, just a suggestion for people that are trying to get away from the commercialization stuff but still want to give somebody something. I will tell you that I have a very high regard for handmade gifts. And it doesn't have to be, oh, my God, knit me another tacky sweater. It doesn't have to be that. But there are things that people make or put together or something that's meaningful to them, like, you know, a picture of themselves in a Christmas ornament or something. And it doesn't have to be fancy or expensive or any of that stuff. Sometimes people just, they love those things that they could kind of look at year after year and remember you. And you could just be a little part of things. So, you know, if you're trying to get away from this commercialized pushing, look at stuff you can go do. You know, Michael's has crafts or there's things online you can get, all that kind of stuff. So just a suggestion.
Absolutely.
All right. So the next topic, as far as, you know, the dark part of holidays, is privilege. One thing our society doesn't like to admit, never mind adjust to, certain holidays and cultures get privileges above any of the others. Not everyone in America is Western European, and not everyone is Christian. And yet, so many state and local governments, and even our federal government, show unconstitutional preference to Christian holidays. We get Christmas off, even if you're not Christian. But people have to fight about it or plan for Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Yule or Solstice, and so forth, even though they're all around the same time of year, roughly, ballpark. We don't like to admit it and push back on adjusting, even though it's only just a few generations ago that we even officially codified most of these things. Those who are of other beliefs or none at all just sigh and go through the motions because it's an exhausting cause to combat. And this is not to say that people shouldn't have fun or have nice things. It's just that we should be more honest about how unbalanced it is. People get into habits and rituals and traditions are something nobody likes anyone messing with once they're incorporated. So we avoid admitting to and addressing this. And again, I'll pause and check in with you, Dr. Mathis.
Yeah, I would say if you're a person who's a non-traditional person in a whatever the traditional religion is, whether it's Judaism or Christianity or whatever, and you're the odd man or odd woman out, what I would say is honor your traditions. You know, do what you have to do. And call in sick if you have to, or whatever. But, you know, honor what you feel is right. And in general, those of us who are in the majority have a, in my personal opinion, have a responsibility that if we allow ourselves these privileges, we ought to be allowing other people the same privileges. Otherwise, you know, if a rule doesn't apply to everybody, it's really not a great rule in my personal viewpoint.
Yes, and that's pretty much what I'm gesturing at. I mean, I think that people can do their own things, but you run into stuff like, pretty much across the nation, people get Christmas off. You wouldn't dare have your store open except for there's always Chinese food because people got to go out. You know, and these kinds of things. And we just, as a society, we need to admit that it's really privileged that we do that. And not find it shocking that other people have a little resentment about the fact, you know, I'd like to have off work to go prep for Hanukkah or, you know, Kwanzaa or solstice or whatever I'm doing. They don't get treated the same, and even by government entities, which makes me super twitch, but I don't want to make this too political. But it's just that our society really doesn't want to be told that, and they get really snooty if you point out, you know, it must be nice to have your holiday be celebrated by everyone, even if they're not your religion.
Yep.
So I think as a society, we really need to stop pretending we don't know that and maybe be a little more fair so that other people don't have to do a dance and a fight to get the same thing you have. And that's all I'm saying.
Absolutely.
So anything else you want to add to that before we go on?
Nope, I'm good. I'm good.
Okay. All right, peer pressure. Also connected to depression and anxiety and marketing is peer pressure. So many of our iconic, beloved holiday images and expectations are of perfect, lavish decorations, bountiful feasts that belie the exhaustion of prep, cleanup, and originality. We feel pressure to include more people than we can handle. We feel pressure to perfectly caretake all the traditions, pressure to cater to marketing images, pressure to create quintessential memories. We have to surprise people by guessing the perfect gift that they didn't know they wanted and make a secret plan to surprise them with it, just like we see on TV. We have to get engaged. We have to take a unique vacation. There is just so much pressure we put on ourselves and on each other about how to behave and what to do at holidays. If we don't have the cute outfit while making grandmother's foolproof turkey, surprising everyone with the correct gifts and attending all the activities, we tell ourselves we failed. Or sometimes we get surly about the holidays and don't do any of it because we can't seem to manage moderation either, or the word no. And I'm going to stop here and see if you have anything else you'd like to chime in with.
Yeah, basically this goes back to honoring yourself. And the other thing I would like to add is, you know, nature's a balance. And we should emulate nature because nature's pretty smart. And if we balance our lives and live the life more balanced and manage moderation, we're going to be a whole lot happier.
Yes, definitely. All right, and the last one I have entitled cultural butchering. Cultural butchering is a term I made up to refer to the mostly uniquely American insistence on incorporating cultural traditions but not really doing proper homework on how they go, and so presenting them disrespectfully or inaccurately. For example, green beer, green food, and corned beef and cabbage on St. Patrick's Day and calling it St. Patty's, and getting mad when people correct you. More examples, people thinking that Cinco de Mayo is Mexican Independence Day. People treating Thanksgiving like there were no dark parts to the original story and everything was like a Disney movie. People trying to make Christmas, Easter, and Halloween secular when they are not, regardless of what secular commercialized traditions have been invented. People not knowing that so many of our holiday symbols and traditions from Christmas, Easter, Valentine's Day, New Year's, and more were appropriated by the church centuries ago when they were aggressively converting areas heavy with pagan observances. It was a compromise to get agreement from the locals. And pagans who still actively observe the original holidays today have to sit and watch as our popular culture prostitutes their beliefs and then says stupid things about, like, how there's a war on Christmas and nothing is sacred anymore. And then we turn around and have a Christmas tree. Thank you, Romans. We aggressively promote patriotic holidays, mock those who don't show off their support, and yet neglect our veterans who came home. We confuse Memorial Day, Armed Services Day, and Veterans Day, and turn two of those into excuses to get off work, barbecue, and shop. We have this need to push back against hearing these facts about our beloved traditions, even when we're wrong, and even when we wouldn't even recognize many of them just a couple centuries ago, because our media, advertising, and degraded word of mouth tell us that we're right. I'm actually not aware of a specific term that refers to this behavior, but maybe Dr. Mathis will be able to speak to that part. So what is it with people that cannot do their homework and they want to do stuff and then they get snooty when you tell them? Why do we do this? What is wrong with us?
It's called lazy and delusional.
I didn't know it was a specific term for this kind of behavior. I don't know.
Yeah, it's lazy and delusional. That's my official diagnosis. Wait. People are really bad about changing and really stubborn about it, because I think what happens is they feel like if they give up the myth, which is what we're really talking about, if they give up the mythos and they have to, and they realize that some of their cherished long-term, in some cases, sacred beliefs are wrong, then they go, well, wait a minute, if this is wrong, then this is wrong, then this is wrong, and oh my gosh, I'm losing my grounding. What am I going to do? Well, you're going to go back and regroup and reground with right facts, and then you're going to move on and be a healthier person. But most people don't do that because they're afraid. And they're afraid of what it means if they have to reexamine their stuff. Oh, no, I can't do that. Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. So they stick their fingers in their ears and do the la-la-la-la-la thing and act like, that they didn't hear you, or they attack you because they figured if they can shut up the messenger, they don't have to listen to the message. So it's really out of fear and about insecurity and, low self-esteem / self-efficacy and not really having confidence that they can go back and retool their belief system and still be okay and whole, which of course we all can do. But if you don't believe you can do it, then you can't.
Okay, that's fair. Alrighty, so the next part is just conclusions, kind of a wrap up. So in summary, humans deal with the chaos and dangers of life by creating deliberate structure and routine on which they feel they can rely, be assured, and belong, and holidays are one aspect of that. Modern day Americans are obsessed with image and status and make themselves exhausted and anxious with habits of holiday one-upmanship. Our primal need for consistency doesn't well tolerate too much examination of many of the traditions and rituals we have standardized in our society, which can generate disenfranchisement and disrespect. All right. So I'm going to check in with you and see if there's anything else before we wrap the show.
No, I would just say, be true to yourself. Know what you want to do. Know what you believe. If you're questioning your belief, fine. Question it. Find out the truth. If you're right, great. If you're not, readjust. Always do what you feel like doing if you can. And I realize there's sometimes you can't do that, but as much as you can, be true to yourself and don't let anybody bully you into not doing that.
Fair enough. Okay, so this concludes our show on the psychology of holidays. We hope that our listeners can appreciate our societal need for holidays, rituals, and commemorations, while at the same time taking control of and responsibility for marketing, peer pressure, cultural disrespect, and other issues surrounding American cultural habits. So with that, on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and also give our appreciation to those of you who join us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks on Wednesday, November 28th at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on blogtalkradio.com. Please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on.